It is Friday, October 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet wins the Nobel Peace Prize. South Carolina grapples with floods, and Nashville's Grand Ole Opry celebrates its 90th birthday. It's all ahead. The 2015 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet for what the Nobel Committee describes its decisive contribution to the building of a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia in the wake of the Jasmine Revolution of 2011. Well, I spoke with Sami Aoun. He's professor of political science at Sherbrooke University in Montreal, and I asked him for his reaction to this announcement.
Yeah, I'm very happy and satisfied. As you know, in the Arab Spring, Tunisia is still the most important spot of light because all experiences in other countries or the neighbor, Libya or Egypt, or the disaster in Syria and Yemen were really very sad news for the liberals and modernists in the Arab world. So Tunisia, in this Nobel Prize, is now honored because they engage themselves on a dialogue process and to search in a painful way, let us say, the common values and a common platform to put Tunisia on the way of democracy and modernity. And they really deserve it because the newly constitution text of Tunisia is one of the most advanced with regard to democracy and the citizenship equality and the primacy of freedom of conscience and the freedom of speech. People of the quarter, the leftist and the most secularist trend in Tunisia really do their best, and they pay a high price when the Islamist, violent Islamists and radicals assassinated their heroes and their leaders.
Yes, and looking back, of course, the Arab Spring began in Tunisia.
Yeah, sure. Now it's a Nobel Prize, really, for this guy, Mohamed Bouazizi, the vendor who put his life on the stake to perhaps start one of the movement, the most important in the last perhaps 100 years in the area. And let us say that here it's once again, perhaps, against the conspiracy mind who said that the Arab Spring is due for foreign interventions. Actually, in Tunisia, it was a way to accomplish what was beginning, the modernization of Tunisia. And because Tunisia was perhaps more advancing in their modernity, they need only to open their society and to put down the authoritarian regime. But the infrastructure was really very advanced to compare with their neighbors.
Thank you very much, Professor Aoun, for speaking with me today.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
That's Sami Aoun. He's professor of political science at Sherbrooke University in Montreal, Canada. Now for reaction on social media, I'm joined by International Edition's Olin Akish-Olu.
Thank you, Sarah. Well, the big topic right now is this year's Nobel Peace Prize winners. And as was announced a couple hours ago, it went to the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet. And the hashtag Nobel Peace Prize is actually trending worldwide on Twitter right now. Most of what we're seeing is people congratulating the quartet and the country as a whole for winning the award. Some people are surprised that the Nobel Committee didn't choose someone with a higher international profile, like Angela Merkel or Pope Francis, or someone involved with the Iran nuclear deal or currently working with the refugee crisis. But a lot of people seem glad that the Nobel Committee went with sort of an underdog, and they're acknowledging how much turmoil Tunisia encountered after the Arab Spring.
Had a lot of people heard of the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet?
That's a good question. It seems like some people did, in fact, hear of the group previously. A lot of people are just familiar with the problems that the country had introducing democracy after the Arab Spring. But there's also a lot who hadn't heard of the quartet before, and they just heard of them after they won the Nobel Peace Prize this morning. One of the funnier tweets I read was, "Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet, I have all their albums." But it's actually not all positive discourse. One thing I found interesting is some people are using the Nobel Peace Prize hashtag to contrast this year's selection with President Obama's 2011 win. People are using it as a way to criticize the selection process, kind of saying that if they gave it to President Obama, they'll give this award to anyone. For now, the conversation is mostly positive on social media, but it'll certainly be interesting to see if the negative criticism starts to get louder.
Thanks very much, Olin. That's International Edition's Olin Akisholu. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Are you nearsighted and also the firstborn in your family? British scientists have found a link between nearsightedness and birth order. The researchers took information from a UK database of people between 40 and 69 years of age who have had their vision analyzed. After making adjustments for age, gender, and education, they found that the firstborn people were about 10% more likely to be myopic than their later-born siblings. Among the risk factors for myopia are genetic background, the amount of time spent outdoors, and how it is spent doing reading, writing, working with a computer, and the like. The researchers suggest that parents tend to be more attentive to the education needs of the firstborn than those born later. This could mean that the firstborn child does more reading and other so-called near work compared to their siblings, which would increase the odds of them having myopia. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the southern U.S. state of South Carolina grapples with floods. Here in the United States, the Republican widely expected to become the next Speaker of the House of Representatives shocked his colleagues Thursday by announcing he was withdrawing his candidacy. The decision by House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy means the race to succeed retiring Speaker John Boehner is now wide open, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
Chaos in the Capitol as the man many thought would become the next speaker stuns his Republican colleagues just as voting was to begin.
I think I shocked some of you, huh?
Kevin McCarthy said someone else will have to try to heal the rift between conservative and establishment Republicans.
And I think there's something to be said for us to unite. We probably need a fresh face. I'll stay on as majority leader. But the one thing I found in talking to everybody, if we are going to unite and be strong, we need a new face to help do that.
Among those in the running for speaker is Congressman Jason Chaffetz of Utah.
I was absolutely stunned, surprised, and shocked that this happened, but our conference is going to have to do a lot of deep soul searching, and we'll see what happens.
The shockwaves reached across the country to Las Vegas, where Republican presidential contender Donald Trump broke the news at a rally.
You know, Kevin McCarthy is out. You know that, right? And they're giving me a lot of credit for that because I said you really need somebody very, very tough.
Democrats were stunned as well and kept a close eye on the chaos in Congress. White House spokesman Josh Earnest.
There's been a rupture in the Republican Party. It's on display on the, in town hall meetings in Iowa and New Hampshire. But it's also on display in private meetings of the House Republican Conference on Capitol Hill. This is a real challenge for the Republican Party, and it does threaten their ability to win national elections.
The rupture has been a long time coming, says former Republican Congressman Vin Weber.
It demonstrates a great deal of chaos within the Republican Party. Weakness is not necessarily the word I'd use, although I'm not going to quarrel with it, but it certainly demonstrates that the Republican Party is not united.
Fueling the divide is a desire by conservatives to be tougher in dealing with President Obama, says Republican strategist Ford O'Connell.
They just want somebody who's not going to go with the status quo. I think a lot of Republicans feel that we've just been beaten over and over by President Obama and the Democrats in Congress, and what they want to see is somebody who's a fighter.
Republicans put off the vote to nominate a successor indefinitely. And Speaker Boehner says he'll remain on the job until a successor is chosen. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
The threat of localized flooding persists in parts of South Carolina, still reeling from an unprecedented rainfall last week that dumped as much as 50 centimeters of rain, resulting in burst dams, swollen rivers, closed roads, and damaged homes, sending hundreds to shelters. Some drinking water supplies have been disrupted and power lines were downed. At least 17 people have died as a result of drowning and road accidents, all caused by converging weather patterns, including tropical moisture from the south, the impact of a massive hurricane offshore, and a stalled high-pressure system to the north that refused to let the moisture move. One of the hardest-hit areas was the South Carolina capital of Columbia, where reporter Andy Shane of the state newspaper spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty late Wednesday.
You know, essentially, we got 3 months of rain in one day on Sunday. It was really incredible to see how quickly some of our areas flooded. We had a creek near our downtown that rose 12 feet in less than 7 hours. So it was something really of a historical biblical proportions here.
What caused it? Was it the hurricane, which never did appear along the East Coast?
The hurricane played a small role in it. It was more along the lines of just some perfect storm issues with some of the fronts around here where basically some rain got trapped and was very slow, stationary, and just basically just doused the area because of just the way a lot of the weather patterns played over us.
Now you've got to pick up the pieces, and one of those issues is the crumbling infrastructure across the state.
Very much so. We have, you know, even now we still have 400 roads and bridges that are out. Interstate 95 is closed for a 14-mile stretch in Clarendon County, which really impeding traffic on, you know, the main thoroughfare along the eastern seaboard. You know, and we're still looking at, making sure that the bridges are safe. And we've got a lot of washed-out roads that are going to need to be repaired and replaced.
I understand that the tab could run into the hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars.
They haven't put a damage estimate at all on this, but it's easy to understand that this will probably reach into the billions.
South Carolina is a big tourist state. Obviously, that's having an impact.
At the moment, some of our areas were spared the worst of the storm. The area up in what we call the upstate, Greenville, Spartanburg, were spared. Some areas in the coast were not hit as hard. Hilton Head, for instance. There are going to be some areas of Charleston and Myrtle Beach that are going to come back rather quickly. They're unfortunately used to these kinds of storms after years and years and years of hurricanes and nor'easters.
Aside from the infrastructure, there are drinking water supply issues, and still hundreds are seeking shelter outside their homes.
Very much so. We had as many as 40,000 folks who were without water service here, and everyone is still under a boil water advisory. You got to boil your water for a minute before you can consume it. So it's a little troubling. We still have dams, small dams, residential dams that are have burst, and some that are threatening to breach. So that could bring some flooding, even though we haven't had a drop of rain now for a couple of days, and the big rain was 4 days ago.
You're right there in the state capital of Columbia, South Carolina. What's the situation there?
This was sort of ground zero for at least what happened on Sunday. This storm started on the coast. It actually started late last week, really soaked Charleston and a little bit on up the South Carolina coast, and then moved northwest here into Columbia, where, again, it just seemed to get stuck for a day, where it, as I said, just seemed to open up here. So we still have some areas that are flooded. We still have, obviously, a number of lakes that have been emptied because of dams that have burst. And again, we're just I'm sort of in watch and wait mode as we start to really try to figure out the extent of the damage.
Reporter Andy Shane says as flooding in the central part of the state recedes, water will move to low-lying areas, threatening further flooding. He says one of the takeaways from the natural disaster is the need for greater investment in dam safety. He says only $200,000 was spent in 2013 and that most of the dams in the state are privately owned and made of earth. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
International Edition. A legendary country music venue in Nashville, Tennessee, just celebrated its 90th birthday. VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong joins me to talk about the milestone. Well, if you've heard of legends such as Loretta Lynn, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, many of these country music icons' work has been promoted to the world via a radio show called the Grand Ole Opry. Well, now this small radio show grew into a major concert venue and cultural institution. And this past week, it celebrated its 90th birthday with all of the big stars in country music. VOA's Nikki Strong is here to talk with us about it. Nikki, how did it get so huge?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was a small radio show back in 1925, and it was founded by George Hay. And it was a live radio show that featured performances from different country artists. It still airs on WSM AM, which had a huge signal, and it enabled the show to reach an exponentially large audience beyond Nashville, Tennessee. And in the process, it became a huge player in exposing and introducing the world to country music. And the Grand Ole Opry, as a consequence, is credited with helping to shape and define the actual genre. And in the process, it's become a source of inspiration for anyone who wants to perform in country music. Reba McEntire, who said she went to a Grand Ole Opry performance before she was a teenager. Oh. And she saw it and said, I want to do that. And look where she is now. So it's been incredible. And Grand Ole Opry has become the pinnacle of a lot of country artist careers. To be inducted and asked to be a member of the Grand Ole Opry is like being inducted into the Hall of Fame. It's selective, it's elitist, and it's a huge, huge honor.
And now it's moved around a lot, too. It's had 6 homes in 90 years.
Yeah. I think by the time I'm 90, I probably will have moved about 6 times at least as well. It has had 6 homes. At first, it was at the National Life and Accident Insurance Company back in 1925. And then it moved several times between 1934 and 1943. It landed at the Ryman Auditorium before it actually settled into its current Grand Ole Opry House in March 1974. I think one of the cool things about it is that when it moved from the Ryman to its current location, a 6-foot circle of oak was cut from the stage at Ryman and inserted into the new stage at the Grand Ole Opry. So by preserving a piece of the Ryman stage, generations of country music singers can perform on the wood where their legendary predecessors
and performed.
Stood.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
A lot of memories there.
Yeah.
Well, is it just country music artists that have performed at the Grand Ole Opry?
No, actually, I mean, it's primarily a country music venue. That is its claim to fame, and that's where it's committed. But actors and actresses and other singers as well have graced the stage. President Richard Nixon actually was at the Grand Ole Opry, as well as actor Kevin Bacon, James Brown, Stevie Wonder, Kevin Costner, Robert Duvall, just to name a few.
Yeah, quite a variety of performers or visitors there. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you can reach Nikki Strong on Twitter at @VOA_music and on Facebook at VOA Music. You can also hear her on VOA's Country Hits USA. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Elvira. Elvira. My heart's on fire for Elvira.
The music of the Oak Ridge Boys singing their song, hit song, Elvira. Yes, and many people enjoy visiting that Grand Ole Opry down in Nashville. Well, that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sarah Williams, and remember to have a great weekend.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of Energy's National Security Administration announced on September 30th the successful return of the final 5 kilograms of highly enriched uranium spent fuel from the IIN 3M Photon Research Reactor in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, to Russia. This is the 8th shipment of highly enriched uranium from Uzbekistan since 2004 and marks the removal of all highly enriched uranium from the country. Since the Russian research reactor fuel return program began in 2002, the Department of Energy has collaborated with partner countries to successfully repatriate more than 2,200 kilograms of Russian-origin highly enriched uranium from around the world, enough for nearly 100 nuclear weapons. This includes the removal of all Russian-origin highly enriched uranium from 11 countries. Furthermore, this shipment marks the 28th country overall, plus Taiwan, to have partnered with the Department of Energy to become free of all highly enriched uranium. The highly enriched uranium removal was logistically challenging, as it was the first transport of liquid, highly enriched uranium spent fuel by air. The journey began at Uzbekistan's Photon facility, where the material was packaged for road transport to the airport. It was then loaded into another specialized container for transport by air to a secure facility in Russia. This complex operation was the culmination of a multi-year effort between the Department of Energy, Uzbekistan, Russia, and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Following this highly enriched uranium removal, the IAEA will lead efforts to assist Uzbekistan in the decommissioning of the Photon facility, with support from the Department of Energy and the United
Kingdom.
Coming up on The Voice of America, the Learning English program as it is. For more Learning English programs, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Thank you for listening to VOA.